Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air.
How does a man with a near incomprehension of computers end up being one of the foremost users of technology to transform his field? Let's discuss. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Campbell, and in the studio with me, I have Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Campbell. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
Well, we've been discussing this very interesting article from hand-drawn to high-tech. Can you remind everybody what we've been talking about?
Right. Well, we've been talking about one of the great architects in America, Frank Gehry, who passed just last December, and the article is telling us about how Gehry is known for actually two things. One of them, and this is probably the way most people know him, is for his building designs, which tend to be very abstract. That is, they tend not to be practical. They tend not to be conventional, like simple squares and rectangles like most buildings are. Gehry's designs are very full of swooping curves and corners and, you know, sort of, he has a sculptor's view of things, and he creates his buildings in that way too, so that they're not practical like the way a simple rectangle would be. But in addition to his designs, what we're learning is that Gehry was also a pioneer in the use of computer technology in the field of architecture.
Yeah, so he was a man of many facets.
Yes.
Yes, he created these interesting, iconic buildings with lots of curves. And we see some of the pictures of these buildings. We have the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. We have the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles and the Dancing House in Prague. I actually love this one because it actually really does look like the building is dancing.
Yes.
It looks like a couple who's doing kind of a tango or something.
Yes, no, that's a remarkable creation.
Yeah, so these interesting designs, again, he was a sculptor at heart. But in a way, because he created these designs that were so unconventional, a lot of times he ran into the problems of how do I communicate these designs to these contractors, right? It's one thing to be the architect, to design it and to draw it on the paper or whatever, but then to translate it into the real world. How do I actually communicate to the builders, the people who are actually building this building, on how to build it? And that's when he and his firm needed to leverage technology. Now, the technology came from an interesting place. Where was the first technology that they used?
Right. Well, that certainly did come from an interesting place. Gehry was working in the field of architecture, but the computer technology that he ended up being a pioneer of was from the aerospace industry, from the industry that makes airplanes and rocket ships and things like that. The aerospace industry had developed this technology to build their planes and rocket ships and satellites and whatnot. And Gehry somehow found out about it and thought, maybe I could use that to better communicate my architectural designs to the construction workers and the builders and the contractors who will actually create these things.
Yeah. Now, one thing, you know, as we're talking about him, one thing I appreciate about Gehry is he was so, as we've said several times, unconventional and out of the box, right? What I appreciate is that rather than going back into the box or trying to fit back into the mold, he was like, let me recreate the mold.
Yeah, yeah.
In some ways. Let me shape the world to fit me rather than shape me to fit the world.
Right, yeah. No, that's certainly what he did. And like we talked about that line yesterday, how the article describes Gehry as a sculptor at heart. And a sculptor is an artist, someone who is not thinking about how do I build a better mousetrap, as we say. How do I take something that already exists and just make it better or more efficient? A sculptor is thinking about how to show us something in a way we've never thought about it before, right. In a way we've never seen it before. And certainly, you know, you look at the picture of the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, that doesn't look like a museum I've ever seen before,
yeah.
At least, you know, until Gary's creation. We're a little more familiar with it now, but
right.
In 1992, at the time, no one had ever seen really a museum that looked like that.
Right. And I think this is something that I want to encourage our readers. I think many people have ideas that sometimes feel out there or feel that they're crazy or just that they're impossible, right? But what if you having those ideas, that's what's going to be able to make the world better?
Mm-hmm.
That's what's going to change the environment around you. Maybe what you need to do is to figure out how to bring those things into reality rather than suppress them and hide them or try to then go back into the mold. You know, I think sometimes we feel crazy. Sometimes we feel that we don't fit in, but maybe that's your superpower. Mm. Maybe because you don't fit in, you're the one that's going to change the world. And often the ones that do change the world, they're the ones that they think differently. You know, I think about Steve Jobs. I think about other, you know, Elon Musk, people who didn't think conventionally, and then they ended up changing the world. Right?
Yeah, pioneers, as we say.
Yeah.
And the definition of a pioneer means someone who goes first. And that means that at the time, they were doing something that nobody else was doing, or they went someplace that nobody else went, and we're all the better for it.
Yeah, and we often celebrate these pioneers, but after they've succeeded.
Yes.
Before they succeeded, people think they're crazy.
Right. No, it can be a tricky bar to clear, but it's still a bar worth aiming for.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's learn more about Gary Technologies and how his technology has impacted the field of architecture.
Gary Technologies. Gary used this approach on his next major project, his breakthrough masterpiece design for the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao. With a highly complex physical form and an exterior designed to be made from thousands of intricately curved sheets of titanium, the design was anything but straightforward. An advanced 3D model became an early version of BIM, creating a single source of information that could be used by the architects as well as the tradespeople and contractors who built the project. It made a seemingly impossible project possible. It gave us the tools to control our process, Gary once said. I thought that was only valuable to my work because I do very special shapes, but we found over the years that it's valuable to everyone. That realization led Gary's firm to turn its expertise into a service. In 2002, the firm spun off a subsidiary called Gary Technologies, which created an architecture-specific 3D modeling tool based off its experience designing with software built for the aerospace industry. Outside clients, including architecture firms ostensibly in competition with Gary's, streamed in to take advantage of the new toolset.
So we hear next, we hear about Gary's next project here. So again, the breakthrough in technology came when Gary was commissioned, his firm was commissioned to design this large pavilion for the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona. He designed a massive abstract fish, which caused him to discover the need for technology to communicate his design. Well, his next major project was the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, and I looked it up, and he started this building in 1993 and finished it in 1997, so it took him 4 years to complete this building. Now, this building had a highly complex physical form. We can see all the different curves and swoops here, and an exterior designed to be made from thousands of intricately curved sheets of titanium. So again, it's not a conventional way of building.
Right, right. And if you look very closely at the photograph there, you can see there's a slight sort of rippled effect to those big sides of the building. And so you realize those aren't just big, long sheets of metal, 30, 40, 50 meters high or wide, but like it says, thousands of smaller, intricately curved sheets of titanium.
Yeah. So the design was anything but straightforward, right? So when we think about buildings, you know, we think about laying bricks or, you know, maybe more conventionally like the log cabins, right? Mm-hmm. Straightforward, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as complicated. But he's definitely doing something that is new, something that is not conventional. And these shapes and swoops and curves, and he's also using unconventional materials for this building. It needed some sort of technology to be able to communicate his designs, right? And so he created an advanced 3D model that became an early version of BIM. And again, the BIM was a single source of information that could be used by the architects as well as tradespeople and contractors who built the project. So it made a seemingly impossible project possible. Okay, so again, we talked about the word improbable yesterday. So this building felt very improbable, but through the technology, it did become possible. So how did this technology help him?
Right. Well, as Gary says here, there's a quote, it gave us the technology, it gave us the tools to control our process. He goes on to say, I thought that was only valuable to my work because I do very special shapes, but we found over the years that it's valuable to everyone. And this is interesting and part of the reason why Gary is so well known for his development of technology in the field of architecture is because this aerospace industry technology that he originally developed for his own designs, it turns out that's useful even for more conventional designs, even for so-called everyday straightforward architecture.
Right. Yeah, so he thought, well, because I do things that are so out of the box, so different, so not conventional, it's probably only necessary for me to use this technology. But what he found was that other companies were actually, no, actually, this could help me too. This could be beneficial. So what happened as a result of that realization?
Right. Well, as a result, Gary's firm, turned that into a service, an additional sort of side business for them. In addition to designing buildings and practicing architecture, the firm spun off a subsidiary called Gary Technologies in 2002. The past tense of spin, means we hear that with TV shows sometimes. Mm-hmm. A popular TV show will spin off another show based on one of the characters from that show, and it just means to develop something from an original source, an original version of it. And subsidiary, that word there, meaning a company that is owned or controlled by a larger company. In this case, the subsidiary, Gary Technologies, owned and controlled by Gary's architectural firm.
Right. So he had his firm. They were focused on architecture. They developed this technology, and then they created a second company under the whole architecture firm that focused more on the technology, the architecture technology, right? And it created an architecture-specific 3D modeling tool based off its experience designing with software built for the aerospace industry. So basically, they took the original technology, the software meant for the building airplanes and rockets, and then they made it more specific for architecture.
Right, so that other firms, other architecture firms who wanted to use it, wouldn't have to go through the process of adapting it from the aerospace format that Gary originally used it from. Gary sort of translated it, we might say, into a way that architects could use it without having to know anything about the aerospace industry.
Yeah, and the next sentence here I found very fascinating. It says, outside clients, including architecture firms ostensibly in competition with Gary's, streamed in to take advantage of the new tool set. What does this word ostensibly mean?
Yeah, interesting word, ostensibly. Something is ostensibly true, people say that it's true, but it's not really true. That's one way to understand it. Another way to understand ostensibly is simply that from one perspective, A is true, but from another perspective, it's not, or it's complicated in some way. And in this case, the complication is these other architecture firms who are competing with Gary for those commissions to design museums and Olympics pavilions and such are nevertheless coming to Gary Technologies to take advantage of the new tool set, as the article says, this new technology Gary has developed so that they can compete better with Frank Gehry.
Yeah.
So it's ostensibly, we say ostensibly in competition, but there's this complicating factor of them wanting something Gary has created in order to also perform better. So in one sense, they're in competition with him, but in another sense, they're paying him money.
Right. And I think that's very interesting, right? Because, him having this technology, it's kind of an advantage.
Yeah.
And he could easily just keep that advantage for himself. And that then becomes his competitive edge with other companies. But rather than doing that, he's actually opening up the technology to other companies and allowing them to also access the technology. In other words, then that kind of raises the competition.
Kind of, it makes them more competitive.
Yeah, it takes away the edge in some ways. But I feel like there's a lot of models of that, right? I think about, Elon Musk and him opening up his designs for electric vehicles and just making it open source, anybody can access, And I think there's a phrase that I often think about is the rising tide raises all boats, right? And I feel like in a sense, that's kind of what he's trying to do is just kind of improve the whole industry of architecture.
Right. Because all boats are in the same body of water tied up to the dock or the shore or whatnot. And when the tide comes in, all the boats rise. The good boats, the bad boats, the big boats, the small boats, they all rise because they're all in the water. And the expression means, something like this that benefits everyone, even if some people might want it to benefit just them and not someone else.
Yeah. And so in a way, he's kind of improving the whole industry. And that's what we've been talking about, is that he not only created these iconic designs, he also improved the technology that just improved the industry as a whole. Yeah. All right. So how did it all begin? How did it all begin? And how did we make this transfer into technology? Let's read the rest of our article.
It began with pencil and paper. This emphasis on technology stood in contrast to the analog design style of Gary himself. He would sit down with you and be ripping paper apart and crunching up paper, and he'd be drawing and sketching, says Samuel Omens of Autodesk, the architecture, engineering, and construction software company behind industry standard design tools like AutoCAD. The technology allowed him to become an orchestrator of data-rich prototype models, not just the maker of drawings. For Frank, this was technology supporting creativity. Without that technology, it's hard to imagine many of Gary's best-known works ever moving past the stage of one of those handmade models. Even so, Gary kept his distance from the computers that enabled so much of his creative success. "I don't know how to turn it on or how to use it," Gary said. "It complicates my life."
That contrast is so interesting. I love that last sentence. "I don't know how to use it or turn it on. It complicates my life." So how does a man who doesn't like computers end up being one of the ones that really pushes this technology into the architecture industry, right? So the emphasis on technology stood in contrast to the analog design style of Gehry himself, right? And this is what we have been talking about, this contrast between paper and pencil, and then now more technology and digital design,
right.
Okay? And we have a quote here from Samuel Omens of Autodesk. How does he describe Gehry?
Right. It's a good quote from Mr. Omens here. He says, Gehry would sit down with you and be ripping paper apart and crunching up paper, and he'd be drawing and sketching, and you just get this sense of a very analog approach to architecture. Instead of punching keys and looking at screens, you sit down with Gehry and it's all paper and ripping apart paper and crunching up paper. And honestly, I'm not the first one to notice this, but you could say that some of his buildings look like he took a piece of paper and crumpled it up and said, that's it. That's the design for the building.
Yeah.
A big piece of crumpled up paper.
Yeah. So he's an analog guy. He was doing all this, but he then adapted technology, and the technology allowed him to become an orchestrator of data-rich prototype models, not just the maker of drawings. Right,
yeah, good word there, orchestrator, like a conductor who conducts an orchestra. Someone who orchestrates, an orchestrator, is someone who performs like the role of a conductor. In this case, Gehry, orchestrating, conducting these data-rich prototype models.
Yeah. And again, what we're talking about is in the past, it was just this drawing on a piece of paper. But now with all the data-rich prototype models, you actually can go into the details of, okay, how many nails do we need? How are we going to actually, you know, how many pieces of titanium and where do they go? How big are the, it just goes into a lot more detail. And this allowed him to be more intricate and to actually create more swooping designs, as we've been talking about.
Right.
And for Frank, I love this. It says, this was technology supporting creativity.
Yeah.
So it didn't take the place of creativity.
Exactly.
And I think that's one thing that a lot of people are talking about nowadays with AI.
Yes.
Is AI taking the place of creativity?
Yes.
But he was using technology to support his creativity. He still drew things out on paper. He still designed the analog way. But then he used technology to then transfer his analog designs into the real world.
Right, right. The technology didn't come up with the ideas for the building. That still came out of Gehry. The technology enabled him to communicate these designs so that they could become reality.
Yeah, and that's what it says here. Without the technology, it's hard to imagine many of Gehry's best known works ever moving past the stage of one of those handmade models, right? And we saw that yesterday. It says that the contractor, he tried to create these designs and he failed 6 times.
Yes. And, you know, you got to be a little worried after the third one fails, frankly. You know, I don't know how many chances they're going to give this guy before they go to another contractor. But he got 6 chances to try to get it right. And after that, they said, hey, maybe this aerospace technology can help explain what I mean a little more.
Right. Now, without this technology, it's hard to imagine any of these designs actually becoming reality, right? But even so, Gehry is not some computer guru. Like we said, he's not some secret computer genius. He was born in 1929, and he actually kept a distance from computers, you know? So he wasn't like most of us nowadays, you know, with our phones attached to our hands and we're just staring at it at all times, right? He actually says he didn't know how to turn it on or use it, right? It complicates his life.
Yeah, Gehry, it's fun. It reminds me of this great quote from another great 20th century artist, the painter Pablo Picasso, was quoted once as saying, computers are useless. They can only give you answers.
Yeah. So in a way, it's almost like a love-hate relationship, I would say, you know. But I love that he was not so tied down to, well, no, it has to be analog. It has to be this way. He actually was able to embrace technology.
Yeah, he didn't. There's an English word, a Luddite. He was not a Luddite. A Luddite means someone who deliberately avoids using modern technology or sometimes just anything that's new. A Luddite, you know, we have that phrase, an early adapter, someone who makes use of new technology as soon as it comes on the marketplace. A Luddite would be the opposite of that, someone who is the last person to ever use a smartphone or a personal computer or even a car, depending on how far back you go.
Right. Yeah. So he actually, even though he himself avoided computers, he was able to embrace the technology. And I think, again, this is a sign of he had a really great team around him.
Yes.
And he was not a dictator and he was not one that's like, well, you know, my way or the highway.
Right.
He was actually willing to work with others and be able to listen to other people. I think it had to be. You know, that's not written in the article, but it had to be. Otherwise, how does an analog mind become someone who embraces technology?
Right, right. How do you go from hand-drawn to high-tech?
Yeah. Well, what about you? Are you of the analog mind? Do you like paper and pencil, or do you like technology? Where do you stand on this? And what are some ways that maybe you feel that you can change the world? Do you have any ideas that maybe could be out of the box or different, but could potentially help to improve this world? We'd love to hear from you. Share with us your thoughts and your opinions. Write to us and come back again and study more English with us as we learn more about this world. Thank you for joining us. And until next time, this is Campbell.
And this is Peter.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.